Being a school superintendent is not all it's cracked up to be. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Palm Beach and Broward counties are two of the largest school districts in the country, and both are now in need of a superintendent. School districts across the country are seeing superintendents resign or be pushed out in record numbers. The pandemic played a big role. Is it still a coveted job? Also, we're going to get an update from Haiti, which is now under new leadership. What's it like for the diaspora here in South Florida who have family back on the island? And finally,
it's a nightmare. It's one of the worst things I had to ever go through.
Speaking of Haiti, we're going to meet a South Florida woman who qualified to represent the country in the Olympics, but one Olympic committee might keep her from fulfilling that dream. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Principals, teachers, and school administrators are preparing for classes to begin in South Florida next month. As the pandemic continues to spread, particularly among unvaccinated youth, schools have a lot of challenges on their hands, and they're missing leadership. A recent investigation from the Washington Post reveals that superintendents across the country are leaving their jobs in droves. The pandemic has created rifts between parents, politicians, and teachers' unions. In South Florida, there's a search for a new superintendent in Palm Beach and Broward counties. Joining us now is Valerie Strauss, one of the authors of that Washington Post investigation, and Andrew Mara, education reporter for the Palm Beach Post, both joining us now. I appreciate your time, both of you. Andrew, I got to start with you. I mean, only after a few years, Dr. Finoy, the superintendent of Palm Beach County, stepping down. Why?
That's right, Lewis. He is stepping down after about 3.5 years. And he says the reason really does have to do a lot with the pandemic and the stresses of this past year. He's a relatively young superintendent. He's 45. He has a young family, 2 children. And he said the last year and all the sacrifices he had to make just made it untenable for him to continue in that position and still be a father and do his familial duties.
Did this catch the district and the school board by surprise, or did anybody have a clue?
People in the district were not surprised that he left. He had had a pretty rough year the past year between all the stresses of the job, some worsening relationships with school board members. So people weren't shocked that he was leaving. The timing was a little surprising. I think people thought he might stay through the end of the calendar year. But certainly anytime the superintendent does leave, people are dismayed and concerned.
And what have you heard from your readers, especially parents? How are they responding to this?
Well, there is a lot of concern about the fact that a superintendent is departing right as the schools are getting ready to open completely for the first time in now a year and a half. The district doesn't seem to think it's going to be a problem because logistically a lot of these issues have already been resolved. We're a few weeks out from the opening of schools, but a lot of the tough decisions that have to be made have already been made as far as masks and social distancing and that sort of thing. But still, as a parent, you can understand why many would be concerned to hear that, as the school year starts again for the first time, many students returning to campus for the first time in over a year, why the departure of a superintendent might seem worrying.
Valerie, as I mentioned, 2 superintendents in South Florida have left their posts, Palm Beach and Broward counties. But this is not a local issue. This is, your story looked at superintendents across the country, so many leaving their jobs or they're getting knocked out of their jobs. Do we have a sense of how many are stepping down? Is this a record year?
It's hard to put a solid number on it. The organizations that represent superintendents don't keep determinative lists of who comes and who goes. But by all the anecdotal evidence, this seems to be an unprecedented time for departures. If you just take one state, New Hampshire, they ordinarily have about 12 superintendents who go. This year, so far, it's 20. So it's a problem that is the pandemic has really spurred the number of departures of superintendents whose jobs have gotten a lot more difficult over the years and were really exacerbated by the pandemic.
You know, as your story pointed out, I thought it was really interesting that you look at the biggest school districts in the country, New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, losing their superintendents. I'm just wondering, are those positions, do they tend to be less stable because they're such massive districts? Is it better to have a job, perhaps, maybe in a smaller district? Or again, from your investigation, it doesn't really matter this year, and a lot of superintendents are just leaving.
Well, this year, that's true. You know, there's a common wisdom that's actually wrong, that school superintendents in the big cities stay for an average of like 3 years. Actually, a study was done fairly recently that says it's 5.5 to 6 years. And so the big city superintendents actually stay longer probably than a lot of rural ones. But it's unique what's happening right now. And they're for different reasons. The New York City superintendent left after having a fight with the mayor over how to integrate schools. Los Angeles, Austin Bettner is leaving because he says he's frankly exhausted. This is a man who was the chief executive officer of the Los Angeles Times. He was once a deputy mayor. He was an investment banker. And this job, which he had for 3 years during the pandemic, became completely, you know, he said like 24/8 jobs for all superintendents. And a lot of them, the stresses of it, they just didn't want to do it anymore.
And that's an amazing part, too. When you mentioned that, you look at all the jobs this man has had, the positions he's held, and he's saying this one is the one that's burnt him out. That is incredible.
Right.
Andrew, Dr. Fenoy was only on the job, as you mentioned, 3.5 years. Palm Beach County, though, is now looking for its fifth superintendent in a decade. Why has it been so hard to find somebody?
Well, it's a great question. One of the most important questions really facing the school district. And it's one that's hard to answer in a lot of respects because really only the superintendents themselves know the actual reasons they're leaving. In most cases, it's probably a combination of factors. Our last two superintendents were both really young, you know, four superintendents. They're both in their 40s. They both had young families, children in school. I think that was probably a factor in at least the last two departures. Previous superintendents have been a little bit older and didn't have young children at home at the time. So that was probably part of it. And that may just be sort of a quirk where we just happen to have two young superintendents and perhaps future ones will be a little bit older and that won't be as much of a factor. But as Valerie pointed out, this is happening all over the country.
And you know, something with Dr. Fenoy, there was another thing too, because we've been talking about the pandemic and I want to get into that a little bit more, but there was also a recent controversy as you've reported on, which is, you know, the school district had planned to include this language of, quote, white advantage in their mission statement. And that got a lot of parents in the district really angry. Did that contribute in any way?
That's another great question. He has not said that. And I don't know that was the case. If I had to guess, I would suspect he has already had these plans in mind before that happened that really kind of erupted in the last couple of months. But that certainly couldn't have made things any easier for him. And really the school board themselves kind of faced the most of the brunt of anger for that, because that really was a policy drafted by the school board as opposed to the superintendent and his staff. But certainly there was some fallout from that. I can't imagine that made the decision to stay any easier.
Yeah, Valerie, I remember covering this story, I mean, from so many different points of view over many years. I've covered the story of school districts looking for superintendents. I recall a little over 10 years ago that it was almost like school districts are looking for that rock star leader who would turn everything around, turn around the bad schools, turn around test scores. But I'm wondering if from your investigations, if the position now is just tainted, less desirable. It's just not something people want to even try.
Well, I think the answer to that is yes. The job over the last few decades, and certainly over the last decade, has become far more complicated than ever for different reasons. The governance, the operations of districts have become more difficult. The requirements for superintendents on student achievement with so much with funding and things tied to test scores has made the job harder. During the last year, the social justice movement that rose out of the police murder of George Floyd has pitted some superintendents with their boards as to how to pursue an equity agenda. And some superintendents have lost their jobs over it. maybe, you know, as Andrew said, maybe that was a factor in Palm Beach at the end and helping Knorr decide what to do. I don't know, but it has clearly been an issue in some other departures. And you're right. You know, 10, 15 years ago, there was a trend away from educators as superintendents and instead to find army generals, business entrepreneurs, people who supposedly knew how to run organizations, and it didn't matter whether they had experience running a school district.
Right.
And so there was this idea you could disrupt, like you were, so much was being disrupted, so many industries, that you could disrupt this with a different kind of leader. And, you know, what happened was that many of them came to realize that running a civic institution like a school district is very different than running a business. And so that era has sort of didn't really work as its supporters had hoped in raising student achievement. It really wasn't the answer. But over time, as the job has become more complicated, it really is harder to find people who want to do it.
And how much is politics, because you brought this up, I mean, how much has politics played a role? You had during the pandemic, legislators and governors saying, we got to reopen schools. And now the big controversy is lawmakers, you know, trying to reset the curriculum on this idea of critical race theory. I mean, so it's become even more political.
Absolutely. And it has been, you know, over school choice for some number of years, too. You've got like there's a county in Colorado where there's constant fights on the school board and about charter schools. And every time there's an election, the majority switches either for and against. And that puts the superintendents in some difficulty. And that's not just in that district in Colorado. There's a lot of school choice disagreements between superintendents and boards.
Yeah. And as we pointed out before, too, not necessarily just in the big school districts. This could be happening in states all across the country, small school districts.
Absolutely.
Talking with Valerie Strauss, reporter from The Washington Post, and Andrew Mara, reporter for The Palm Beach Post, we're looking at the position of school superintendent. Why are there so many superintendents across the country stepping down? Only after a few years in some cases. In Palm Beach County, Dr. Donald Fennoy announced his resignation this month. Broward County will be looking for a new superintendent as well. And by the way, if you live in Broward or Palm Beach County, I'd love to hear from you on this. As the school districts are now beginning that search, what should they be looking for? What do you want to see in a leader coming in to take over? Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Would love to hear your thoughts on that. Andrew, what have we heard from the school board in Palm Beach County as to when they're going to start looking, and do we have any idea of what they're looking for?
Yeah, so the search is getting underway already, and actually today the school board will meet and have their first real discussion about what the next steps are, whether to have a national search, whether to just hire someone internally, whether to hire an interim for the short term, whether to look for a permanent. So all those questions are being hashed out now and in the upcoming weeks. As far as who they want, a lot of students do say a lot of school members have said they really want someone who knows the district itself, who isn't going to come in and shake things up just for the sake of shaking things up. There also is a sort of a thirst for a return to a focus on academics. The last few years have been really dominated by concerns about school security after the Parkland school shooting massacre. Then, of course, the pandemic, where really health issues were, you know, really dominated all the attention at the highest levels. So academics have really taken a back seat, strangely enough, in the last couple of years. And there's a real desire to have someone come in who's a real academic expert. We'll put more of a focus on things like, you know, raising reading and math scores and that sort of thing.
And by the way, Andrew, what did Dr. Fennoy say anything about how the pandemic affected his ability to do his job?
Well, he said the pandemic was part of the reason he's stepping down now, as opposed to maybe further down the road. He said, you know, the stress levels from constantly working, constantly making hard decisions, and sort of the fog of war was really tough. And he's talked about that a lot. It was really hard to make a decision at any given point because things were changing so quickly. Make a decision in June about how to reopen schools, and by July, you're looking at a whole new set of facts, and any decision you made, you may have to undo. So I know that was frustrating for him. And then he hasn't said this, but something to keep in mind, of course, is just the white hot focus of politics is really front center on schools this past year. from the, you know, you had the president tweeting about school reopening, the governor, of course, and that schools really aren't used to being really that much front and center in the political debates at the federal and state level. So I think that was an additional complexity. Perhaps he wasn't really expecting or fully ready for.
Valerie, in your story, you talk about, and you mentioned it just a little while ago too, the association that helps that works with school superintendents. It's the AASA, I believe. They work on programs to try to help superintendents deal with the stresses of the job. And I'm wondering, what are they doing right now? What are they saying about, again, this unprecedented number of people just walking away from the job?
The Dan Dominick, a former superintendent of Virginia, who's been directing the American Association, the Superintendents Association, represents all of the superintendents in this country, has said quite clearly that he's never seen superintendents be under so much stress that some of them were calling him saying, we need help. So what he did was put together kind of a support group where superintendents could talk to each other and exchange plans, exchange, you know, personal issues they were having, trying to keep their students safe as well as their families safe. And that has helped in a good number. There's a couple dozen superintendents who are actively involved in this group. And then there are smaller groups. In Georgia, a number of superintendents get together to talk about what they're doing and how they can possibly help each other. So I think we've never really seen this kind of crossover outreach with superintendents trying to deal with an unprecedented problem.
And, you know, I want to ask both of you this. Valerie, I'll start with you, because you mentioned how, you know, at one point, school districts were looking for people outside of academia for a different type of leadership. And Andrew had mentioned that, too, what is the most important thing to look for in a superintendent? Is it somebody who comes from schools, or is it somebody maybe who knows more about security or other issues? But what about from the tech sector? Valerie, have you heard anything about that? Because, I mean, that's, especially this past year, we had to go to homeschooling. Everybody had to go home to learn. I don't know. Is that a place, you know, Silicon Valley, is that a place to start looking for leadership? Have they mentioned that?
I think if you asked people who have been involved in these searches, my guess is that they would say not as the head leader. That's a very limited skill set to understand the technology. That a good leader needs to have really great communication skills, that there are other things to look at first besides understanding and knowledge of technology. It would be great to have somebody who could do all of that, but I would think it's more important to have somebody who understands what school districts do, who understands school district operations, who have some background in education, but also understand all the new trends and want to put together a staff, which would include people who knew the technology and could and have a person who's willing to listen to people who know parts of the system that they don't.
Andrew, I mean, the same to you, but I'm also wondering what you've heard from your readers about, you know, what they hope this, you know, Palm Beach County is going to do and who they hope to hire.
Well, as you can imagine, there's a wide range of opinions about what the superintendent should do and who the next superintendent should be. But I think the real immediate focus is on getting someone in place quickly and really getting stability back in place. I think that's really what people are most concerned about, not even so much about who the particular superintendent is at any given time, but the fact that there's been so many in recent years. Some people, of course, do want more focus on academics. Other people really are concerned with things like mask requirements in schools, understandably. So it really runs the gamut. But I think everyone agrees that more stability would be, a real essential quality moving forward.
Valerie Strauss, reporter with the Washington Post. Andrew Mara with the Palm Beach Post. You can find their reports on our social media at WLRN Sundial on this issue of school superintendents. Valerie, Andrew, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Lewis.
It seems like right now there are a lot of opportunities. If you think you could lead a district, there are a lot of jobs open. So, I don't know. Give it a shot. By the way, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this. I mean, again, if you live in Palm Beach and Broward counties, They're looking for new superintendents. What do you want to see in the leadership? You can always tell us. Join our Sundial Text Club. Just type the word hello to 786-677-0767. Again, that's 786-677-0767. Just type hello. And you know what? You can join the conversation on conversations like this one. Just I really want to know, what do you want to see in leadership in Palm Beach or Broward counties on as a school superintendent? Who should they hire? Well, still to come, 2 weeks following the assassination of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse, we're going to hear from community leaders about getting help back to their home country. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Slain Haitian President Jovenel Moïse will be laid to rest this Friday, as many within the country continue to mourn. Prime Minister Ariel Henry was inaugurated yesterday. He explained that his main priority is to ensure fair and safe elections within the next 3 months. Many within the Haitian diaspora in South Florida remain concerned about safety on the island as the investigation into Moïse's assassination continues. Gang violence remains a critical problem, as well as rising COVID cases. Paul Christian Namphy is a lead organizer with the Family Action Network movement. That's a nonprofit organization supporting the Haitian diaspora in South Florida. Paul, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Also joining us is Pierre Imbert. He is the CEO of the IT Community Trust. Pierre, thank you for joining us today.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
And by the way, both men spent extensive time working in Haiti in the aftermath of the 2010 earthquake. Paul, I want to start with you. From your conversations with residents and families across Haiti, what's the mood right now back in the country?
The mood is a mood that is very tense. We are dealing with real security challenges. And the people really have a pro-democratic vision and their hopes for and aspirations for a better Haiti. But right now we see that much of Port-au-Prince is under the control of armed groups. The Martissant, they've cut off for the last 2 months. Basically, Port-au-Prince and the rest of the country is cut in two, so that actors in the population can't move about to meet their responsibilities. And we've seen a terrible wave of violence. And I recall, based on an FKJL report, that in the last week of June, up to 60 people were murdered by these armed groups, including unfortunately, a women's rights and human rights activist, Marie-Antoinette Duclair, a journalist, Diego Charles, and this violence, which culminated, of course, in the death of the former president. So we really need a return to stability, to security, and to find a way, really, for the decision-making to be led by Haitians. We're looking for a Haitian solution to this crisis.
And Paul, my understanding, too, is that your daughter is still in Haiti with family. For the summer, what has she told you about her experience?
That's correct. So very fortunately, my daughter, Christiana Jeanne, is currently outside of Port-au-Prince, fortunately. But this is a very tense situation because of the uncertainty. We don't know what is going to happen. I mean, she's in school here in South Florida, and she needs to return to classes. So it's a very tense situation, even about flights going out of the country, you know, the border, you know, being closed. So it's a very, very tense situation. And, you know, we are in constant communication. But my drama is the drama of the majority of members of the Haitian American community here in South Florida, where we have immediate relatives who are inside Haiti and who really are at the whim of the current crisis and how it's playing out. And we really extend our thoughts and prayers to everyone who's going through this ordeal.
Pierre, your organization is focused specifically on community development here in South Florida and in the rural parts of Haiti. Before the assassination of President Moïse, what were the bigger challenges that the residents there were dealing with in Haiti?
Well, first of all, Haiti's been dealing for the past better part of the last decade into what was obviously an economic collapse, in that people were left on their own. There's not really economic policies that you could count on. You have to struggle for a living. And then that's been the case, whether you're in rural Haiti or you're in the major cities. It just simply did not work. And the recent events, particularly with the cycle of violence that paralyzed much of the country, you have had a culminating effect of an economy that no longer works. And some people would argue does not even exist at this moment.
So has it, Pierre, has it, I mean, since because you're talking about everything that was going on before the assassination, you're saying all the way back to the earthquake of 2010, there's just been that an instability. But, you know, in this short period of time since, has it gotten worse or is it just still the same?
Well, it has worsened significantly as people deal with the shock of something that they experienced they never thought they would experience in the country. It's been more than 100 years since a Haitian president was assassinated. Then the shock led to dismay over the fact that Haiti is on the news for all the wrong reasons. And then second, they're still dealing with unabated violence that you see without any sort of response from the police force or from anybody for that matter. So you can imagine what it is to scrap a life out of this chaos and uncertainty. And then I insist on uncertainty. There is a reason to think of a way forward. I agree with Paul. The path forward needs to include the Haitian voices, and then those voices are being silenced.
And I want to get to, you know, we talk about how Haiti moves forward, but interestingly enough, as you had mentioned too, you talk about going back to the earthquake. And Paul, I want to start with you because both of you, as I mentioned, assisted, you know, the country as it was dealing with the aftermath of that earthquake. But also there was the cholera outbreak, and then of course now the pandemic. But Paul, how have these disasters and health crises complicated the politics within the country?
So I am speaking as the former municipal coordinator for the Public Water and Sanitation Authority in response to the earthquake, and later on as the National Cholera Response Coordinator, and then the coordinator in the fight against COVID, also for DINEPA, which was National Water and Sanitation Authority. So we see that Haiti has a series of structural difficulties that always plague the functioning of government, the functioning of the providing of services. And during these times of crisis, whether it's the earthquake, whether it's cholera, whether it's Hurricane Matthew, these all taxed the system in its ability to provide services. After the earthquake, the central authority was decapitated. The majority of the buildings were crumbled. I remember the women's ministry, the Women's Rights and Feminine Condition Ministry of Haiti, was lost many of their high level decision makers, many of whom I personally knew, and so it is a huge difficulty in terms of the ability to provide services. But I believe that even outside of those questions, we still have major governance issues where the people feel that even when there isn't a crisis, this government is not providing services to them. The decision makers are not making decisions in the interest of the Haitian people. And that is really the crux of the difficulty that we're facing right now.
And by the way, that issue extends beyond Moïse. Right, Paul?
Absolutely. I mean, we saw the country has been paralyzed from July 2018 until now. A huge issue that the people felt that the former administration clearly was not acting in the interest of the people. That's as clear as day. But this is obviously a problem that's bigger than one individual. And this is a problem that has obviously survived beyond the death of that individual. And we need to say that this, even the people who have replaced him, this we're not in the bounds of the constitutional order at all. And we are asking for a broad-based, inclusive dialogue to really set the stage for how we can define short-term and long-term strategies for inclusive development across gender, across groups that have been disenfranchised, locally empowering women and men politically and economically. That's what they need, and it needs to start with the voice of the Haitian people.
Pierre, you know, you look back as again, back to the earthquake, the cholera outbreak, Hurricane Matthew, as Paul had mentioned, now the pandemic. Just wondering, did you see throughout any of these disasters that aid organizations were coordinating with Haitian communities to get resources to people? What were the bigger challenges? Did it ever get any better?
I think there were, to be honest, there was really some positive signs at the beginning. I think one couldn't help but notice the extraordinary solidarity of the world community with Haiti post-quake, shortly after the quake. But I think this is an opportunity presented that was squandered by a lack of real coordination, and also putting Haitians at the driver's seat when it comes to carving a future for their own country. And then it moved from the aid, a lack of efficiency in delivering the aid, and then today you look at the results; they don't look too good. Hence, that continue to worsen, and I think it culminated to what we're living today.
But going back to what Paul said, how much of that has to do with governance?
Governance is key here. You cannot aspire to build a democracy, a young democracy, unless you have the institutions of democracy in place. And then that there begins the governance. And also you need to have partners who understand clearly that unless you have the locals making decisions for themselves, they're not going to have ownership of what's going on. Therefore, they would not be encouraged to continue to engage. And you have a very young population in Haiti. And then young people, unless you keep them focused, you support them in achieving their aspirations, well, they're not going to put their energy into rebuilding their country. They put the energy into leaving the country. And that's what we're facing today.
You just heard from Pierre Imbert. He is the CEO of the IT Community Trust. We also are joined by Paul Namphy. He's a lead organizer with the Family Action Movement Network here in Miami. We are discussing the political crisis in Haiti following the assassination of President Jovenel Moise and the role of community organizations, especially here in Florida, in South Florida, providing support for Haitians back home in Haiti. Paul, a group of international diplomats known as the CORE Group recommended that interim Prime Minister Claude Joseph step down so that Ariel Henry, the prime minister appointed by slain President Moise, would take over. So Joseph stepped down on Monday. Henry is now holding the position. But what concerns are there, especially with the diaspora here, about, you know, the international community asserting its influence over Haiti? How much do they want to see, or do they not want to see it at all?
Luis, you hit the nail right on the head. The Haitians inside Haiti, in their vast majority, and Haitians in the diaspora do not want to see the CORE Group nations dictating who or who is not the leader and who should or shouldn't be in a decision-making posture. This is the exact problem that we are facing, because we are looking for decision-making roles for Haitians and for people who adequately represent Haitian society. And this is not a simple crisis that can be resolved with a Band-Aid solution, either like saying that so-and-so is anointed leader or we need to move toward immediate elections while we're facing the situation of armed groups controlling popular, densely populated neighborhoods. And even they mentioned this even when the former president's body was still warm, that it's like, let's move toward elections. We cannot have this situation. Imagine the effect of the fact that one prime minister has handed power to another because the CORE Group said so. This is exactly what we cannot have while we're in this crisis of a vacuum of legitimate constitutional leadership. None of them have constitutional legitimacy right now, and that's why we need to move back toward a broad-based solution. The Commission for a Haitian Solution to the Crisis is one such group that has been, which was launched 2 months ago, is such a mechanism of voices inside Haiti that we need to amplify and call for such mechanisms to be as consensual and as inclusive as possible.
And so is there any confidence then either in Haiti or here that there could be free democratic elections within the next few months?
No, none, zero, impossible. A key human rights organization who was, a member of a meeting that happened just a few hours ago, said as much, that we need to take this step by step. We need this dialogue to really bring forth a mechanism where you can have legitimate decision makers, and it is those decision makers who can say how we need to move this forward. The Constitution remains our compass. Most of the problems of Haiti are not caused by the current Constitution. They're caused because people have refused to follow it, and they're continuing to refuse to follow it. And so this has to be the steps. The election, yes, we are democratic loving people. Yes, we have showed in decades in the past when we had sky high voter turnout that we do embrace elections, but we do not embrace a situation where the electoral outcome is overturned by the same instances that years and decades later say we need to go toward elections.
So, Pierre, I mean, Paul is talking about, you know, there has to be a process. So what does that look like? I mean, does there have to be a referendum? What do you think are the next steps then to make this work?
I think the next step, I think, Lewis, it's worth reminding listeners that the U.S., the United States government is a leading member of the so-called core group, and what we've seen that time and time again, the United States has miscalculated the way forward for Haiti, and hence we've moved from disaster to catastrophe, and then I'm afraid to more misery and death as a result of the lack of considerations for this way forward. Clearly, there isn't going to be solutions brought from the outside that does not involve Haiti, and then that will be successful. Otherwise, it's insanity what we see here, because more of the same just simply cannot do it. I do think I plead to Mr. Biden and his administration. Of all people, he understands the situation. He dealt with Haiti for the 8 years as vice president responsible for Latin America and the Caribbean. And then he has had opportunity to enjoy friendship and decent, and known as a decent person. I think right now he faces a stark choice. Either more of the same, continue with the status quo that will result in more desperation for Haiti, or understands that there is an opportunity here to do good. The U.S. is a force for good, and
yeah,
we hope to continue to educate members of the administration
and
that reality.
As you pointed out again, that the U.S. The leading group in this core group, Paul, you're working with the Haitian diaspora here in your work with FAM. Has this upheaval in Haiti shifted the focus for FAM? Is it more about remittances, resources, getting it back to Haiti? What's changed?
Well, this is exactly the case, that we have always been engaged on the question of Haiti. We have always been engaged on the question of the Haitian American community here and on the inextricable link between, for example, the questions of immigration, between the questions of supporting our right to temporary protected status, which is been amplified by the very fact of the situation inside Haiti. And that was the Biden administration's main rationale for extending, for redesignating TPS for Haiti last May. And we're still waiting for the Federal Register to come out. But these issues are inextricably linked. And we're really asking, why not take the opportunity of this crisis to truly help the people of Haiti to get back on their feet?
Yeah.
I mean, Haitian American voters are a voting bloc, and we really came out very strongly of the 81 million people inside the United States who voted for the Biden-Harris administration, who voted for change, many who voted also in the Georgia Senate elections. We need to really amplify our voice in terms of so that they can do the right thing.
And briefly, just in 30 seconds, Pierre, Moise wanted to get the diaspora more involved in politics. Do you think that's a good idea? Do you think they will?
It's always a good idea to get the diaspora involved. I doubt that Mr. Moise's head was in the right place in that he wanted to illegally change the constitution. That is, the constitution is the mother of all laws. Yeah. And unless you respect it, you protect it, then you're not going to be able to achieve a true democratic society.
Pierre Imbert, CEO of the IET Community Trust, also Paul Namphy, lead organizer with the Family Action Network movement here in Miami. Pierre, Paul, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate the insight.
Thank you for having us.
The pleasure was ours. Thank you so much.
And we'll continue our coverage of this on our website, WLRN.org. Well, still to come.
It's a nightmare. It's one of the worst things I had to ever go through.
She qualified for the Olympics, but she can't compete in Tokyo. A Taekwondo star from Plantation will share her story. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Aaliyah Shipman achieved a feat she'd been training for her entire life, qualifying to take part in the Tokyo Olympics. Aaliyah Shipman! Well, you just heard Aaliyah's mom right there cheering in the stands. Aaliyah grew up in Plantation and has been training in Taekwondo for years in Broward County. She's Haitian American and planned to represent Haiti in the Olympics. But she's not currently in Tokyo, where the ceremonies are about to kick off on Friday. A few weeks ago, she was informed by an Olympic committee that she can't be on the Haiti team. We spoke earlier this morning with WLRN's Palm Beach County reporter, Wilkin Brutus, about this story. Who is Aaliyah Shipman? How do you describe her?
Aaliyah Shipman comes from a multiracial family. They're small business owners. Her great-grandfather's from Haiti, and her mother's of Indian descent. She's from Plantation and trains at a Taekwondo center in Sunrise and fights under the Haitian Taekwondo Federation. She also studies finance and accounting at the University of Miami.
So she's Haitian American. She trains in Sunrise, but she wants to represent Haiti in the Olympics. How does that work?
Yeah, a lot of people don't know how this works. Well, the Olympics allow their athletes with multiple nationalities to effectively change their allegiance whenever they see fit. Circumstances obviously vary from country to country, and reasons vary from athlete to athlete.
So is it my understanding the U.S. Olympic Committee and other governing bodies have taken action to disqualify her from going to Tokyo? Here's what she had to say about that.
This whole situation, it's a nightmare. It's one of the worst things I had to ever go through. Like, the happiest day of my life is when I qualified for the Olympics, so just having it taken away from me, it's so much for me.
Why do they want to disqualify her?
Yeah, of course, before you change allegiance, there's a process to do that. When Aaliyah was 16, she fought for Team USA before switching to Team Haiti. According to the family's lawyer, U.S. Olympic Committee and USA Taekwondo, these governing bodies claim that Aaliyah Shipman violated two eligibility rules. Rule 41... from the Olympic Charter states that someone who is a national of two countries who fights for another country has to wait 3 years to fight for another country. But the rule applies only to athletes 17 years and older. The family's lawyer argues it never applied to Aaliyah because she was 16 when she fought for the U.S. They also argue if there was a problem with Aaliyah fighting for Haiti, the complaint should have been filed before the Olympic qualification. And she had already been competing for Haiti before that decision. So this obviously came as a huge shock for the family.
Yeah, besides a shock. What have they said to you about, their response to this and what they want to do?
Well, the family still wants to take legal action, and so they are still sitting down with their lawyer to see what the next necessary step to take. They try to expedite the case so that Aaliyah's shipment can be in Tokyo in time to actually compete, but it looks pretty unlikely for right now.
Is there precedence for this, or is this an unprecedented situation?
According to the lawyer, this is probably not unprecedented. There has been some internal politics that have gone on throughout Olympic history. For this specific case, it's just extremely shocking for it to come 2 to 3 weeks before the actual Olympics from an athlete that actually qualified for the Olympics.
Have you heard from any Olympic officials or any of the other governing bodies, sports committees on this?
Lewis, unfortunately not. The U.S. Olympic Committee and USA Taekwondo did not respond to my request for comment, and neither did the Haitian Olympic Committee.
So you spoke with Aaliyah's mom, Zara Shipman. She talked about the mental health toll that this is taking on her daughter.
It's been very heartbreaking for her. She hasn't been able to sleep. She feels like she has no purpose. She's just heartbroken. Due to the Olympics being postponed, Aaliyah actually prepared for this for an additional year. And she was in school full-time during this time, a very hardworking girl. And it's just sad to see someone that's worked so hard, you know, come this close to getting their dream and then someone just trying to crush it.
How is Aaliyah coping?
Well, she said the situation was, quote, a nightmare, and that she trained for so many years and never expected an eligibility dispute to get in the way of her competing in Tokyo, especially after being qualified. What I found fascinating from this 18-year-old was her sense of resilience. So she does seem like she's still training. Well, she actually said that she's still training despite the actual dispute.
I'm speaking with WLRN Palm Beach County reporter Wilkin Brutus. We're talking about the upcoming Tokyo Olympics. Aaliyah Shipman, a Taekwondo fighter from Plantation, she was on the verge of competing for Team Haiti, but was disqualified at the last minute. You can find the full story, by the way, on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Okay, Wilkin, the case is in court right now, and the Olympics, as you said, I mean, it's about to start. It's actually opening ceremonies this week. Does a decision have to be made today, tomorrow, I mean, when, before they can say she can or can't go?
So I got an update from the family yesterday. The U.S. Olympic Committee declined an expedited hearing as the family's lawyer had requested. So the family says they may have to, quote, seek other recourse after their decision. Aaliyah Shipman had to be present by the 25th in order to compete. So it's very unlikely she will make it to the Olympics this year.
If she can't compete this time, what's next for her? What's in the future?
Well, like I said earlier, Aaliyah Shipman is still training despite the ongoing dispute. She seemed quite excited about the 2024 Summer Olympics in Paris. But, you know, she's still devastated. But to some extent, she's still optimistic about the rest of her career.
Aaliyah's mother, Zara, also shared with you some concerns about the treatment of Black women and women of color leading up to the Olympics. Here's some of what she said on that.
Different decisions being made, banning swimming caps that for larger hairstyles. Just it's really unfortunate that they appear to be just racist towards biracial or women of color.
What's been the Olympics track record when you talk about Black women and women of color?
Of course, you had the headline-grabbing story about Sha'Carri Richardson, who was a member of the U.S. track team, tested positive for marijuana after her biological mother had passed. That situation provoked commentary from so many angles, but she did break a rule. But there is still a debate about the treatment of Black athletes. There has been a string of controversies, and a lot of fans and athletes have felt a growing sense of exclusion and misunderstanding, from the ban on swim caps for natural Black hair to a rule that restricts female runners with naturally high testosterone levels from competing, which has impacted some Black female athletes.
And how are they addressing these?
Well, as of late, after international outrage, the International Swimming Federation, or the FINA, is reconsidering its ban on swimming caps for natural Black hair. But as of right now, no decision has actually been made or reported. And also members from an anti-racism group from the European Parliament is urging the International Olympic Committee to lift the ban on swim caps, saying this type of ban, quote, leads to institutional inequalities, especially targeting Black women. And so there is politicians who are sort of adding their own commentary to the situation as well.
This is going to be such a strange Olympics, if it happens, because there is still a chance they could cancel it, but there won't be any fans. But did you get a sense, I don't know if they told you straight up from the family, or do you get a sense that if Aaliyah can't go, that they even want to watch the Olympics?
That's a great question. I did not get any sort of inclination that they would ban themselves from watching the actual Olympics. The family does seem a bit competitive. Aaliyah, despite her coping with this devastating news, still seems a bit competitive. And so I have a great feeling that they're going to still watch the Olympics because they're still very much involved in it.
That was WLRN's Palm Beach County reporter, Wilkin Brutus. You can read more about Aaliyah's story, catch more of our Olympic coverage, go to WLRN.org. Aaliyah, I'm rooting for you. If you don't make it this time, get there in a couple of years. Show the world what you're made of. Well, that's Sundial for this Wednesday, July 21st. Coming up tomorrow on the program, COVID cases are on the rise in Florida. Hospitals are starting to feel the pressure on their emergency rooms. We're going to hear from the chief operating officer of Memorial Hospitals in Broward County. Plus, a nursery of hammerhead sharks have made a new home in Biscayne Bay, right here near downtown Miami. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.